to be correct. Come dinner, Leo and the guests were still lounging on various sofas throughout the house. Jonas appeared to be working on a manuscript, or at least he had a stack of paper in his lap, a pencil between his teeth. It was odd to think he'd brought a manuscript to lunch. Eric came in from the pool and allowed that while the idea of more food had seemed impossible just 2 short hours ago, he thought he might be getting hungry again. At the very least, he needed a drink. Leo looked up and smiled. Now there's a thought. After a very long evening, in which Franny didn't need to cook, but did need to heat and plate and serve, after the consumption of an extraordinary amount of wine, and then the raiding of the actresses Calvados and Sauterne for after-dinner drinks. Franny, make a note of what we're stealing, Leo said, rifling through the rack in the pantry. I want to remember to replace it. When everyone had wandered back out to the side porch to smoke, Franny was left with a dining room that looked like Bacchus had thrown a bash. She drew in her breath and began to stack plates. The tall young novelist followed her to the kitchen. For a minute she thought he was interested in helping, before realizing that he was in fact just interested. He was wearing glasses now, though she didn't remember him wearing them earlier when he was reading. My contract is with Knopf, he told her, picking up a wine glass and holding it in a dish towel. Entrez nous, I was hoping for FSG. Ever since I was in college, I've wanted to be published by FSG, but... He shrugged at Franny and leaned against the sink. You know. They didn't want the book? She asked. Jonas looked hurt.
Money, he said. Everyone knows FSG never has real money.
Franny was rinsing the plates when Leo came in. There you are, he called to the young novelist. His arms were wide open, and he was holding a highball glass in one hand. I've been wanting to show you a tree. He could bellow sometimes when he was drinking, and Franny wondered, with all the windows open, if the neighbors could hear him.
A tree?
Jonas said. His glasses were lightly steamed from his proximity to the sink. Leo put his arm around the young man's shoulder and led him away. Come and see it. There's a beautiful night sky. Really, Leo? Franny called after them. A tree? That's the best you can come up with? Astrid didn't spend the night, but somehow the young writer did. Jonas said he was prone to carsickness if he'd been drinking, and certainly he'd been drinking. He looked around the house and declared the entire situation straight up Fitzgerald, so much so that sleeping over would have to be a part of it. Astrid, who would have stayed herself had an invitation been extended, volunteered to drive back for him tomorrow, around lunch. When the last of the actress's Danish china had been returned to the glass-fronted cabinets, and the zinc countertops had been wiped down and the trash taken out, Franny stopped to survey her good work. The house guests had provided her with 3 days' hard labor, but it was a kind of labor she was used to. Not the cooking, maybe, but the refilling of glasses and the emptying of ashtrays, the straightening and fetching, the quiet audience to conversation. Tomorrow was Sunday, and on Sunday it would be over. Franny felt proud of herself. She'd been a good sport. Leo would be grateful for all the many kindnesses she'd shown his friends. After a hungover breakfast in which everyone who requested eggs requested them cooked a different way, Leo announced that he had to work. He put his legal pad and pens and scotch in 2 volumes of Chekhov. Eric had convinced him to write the introduction to the new edition, though, of course, not until his own novel was finished. In a canvas tote bag, and walked across the lawn to the tiny one-room cottage at the back of the property. With its little desk and single bed and overstuffed chair, its ottoman and floor lamp, it was easy to imagine that the place had been built for exactly this purpose. Not to write, because Leo was not writing, but to get away from the hordes of moths that had been drawn to the house's magnificent flame. It's good that he's working. Eric said to Franny, He was holding his coffee cup with both hands, looking wistfully in the direction where Leo had disappeared, the way a woman standing on the beach will look at the place on the horizon where the whaling vessel had disappeared.
"We've got to encourage him, make sure he keeps at it. He can't lose his momentum again."
Franny didn't mention that there was no momentum because there was no book. She wondered what Leo had told him.
"He will," she said vaguely, "once everything settles down and gets quiet." Could she ask him what jitney he was planning to take back to the city?
She looked at Eric, his gray hair long and curling, his glasses pushed to the top of his head.
"Let me know about the jitney," she said. "I'll drive you down. There can be a line on Sunday if you wait too long."
Marisol shook her head.
"Friday was enough for me. I can't even imagine Sunday."
She looked at her husband. "When are you going back?" Eric tilted his head back and forth, as if he were trying to calculate a tip.
"Tuesday? Maybe Tuesday? I'll have to check and see."
Marisol nodded and pulled the style section out of the paper.
"Well, I get an extra day. I came out a day later than you did."
Jonas arrived in the kitchen wearing green swim trunks and a t-shirt.
"Can I just have coffee for now?"
he said, squinting against the morning light.
"I'm going for a swim."
Franny had so much to say, but in that exact moment, she was distracted by the writer's swim trunks, stunned by them.
"Where did you get swim trunks?"
Jonas looked down at himself.
"These? I don't remember. REI?"
In the t-shirt, in the bright light, he looked no more than 20.
"They're yours. You brought them here?"
They were all looking at her now.
"I brought them here,"
he said. He plucked at the fabric with two fingers.
"Are they okay?"
"You brought extra clothes?" He caught her line of questioning and came back at his hostess with an ill-prepared defense.
"I get carsick, and I don't like to ride in cars at night. Astrid said it was a big house."
Franny had been at the market when they arrived. She hadn't seen him come in with a suitcase. She would need to wash the sheets in his bedroom unless he wasn't planning to leave. The phone started to ring, and Jonas, in a gesture of independence, poured his own coffee, and went out the back door.
"I want to talk to my father,"
the voice on the phone said.
"Ariel?"
There was no answer, because the answer would be that Leo had three children, and two of them were boys, and only the girl was speaking to him these days. So if a woman called asking for her father, then yes, it was going to be Ariel.
"Hold on a minute," Franny said. "He's out in the back. I'll have to get him."
Eric gave her a look to inquire as to the nature of Ariel's call, but Franny ignored him. She crossed through the wet grass beneath the cherry trees and past the pool where Jonas was already lying shirtless on the diving board, the cup of coffee beside his head. When she got to the cabin door, she didn't knock.
"Ariel's on the phone," she said.
Leo was stretched across a single bed with a volume of Chekhov in his hands. He looked up at Franny and smiled.
"Would you tell her I'm working? Tell her I'll call her back?"
"Not on your life," Franny said.
"I can't talk to her now."
"Well, neither can I, so I suggest you go down to the kitchen and hang up the phone." She walked out of the cabin and to the back of the property. She knew where there was a break in the hedge, and she took it. Through the neighbor's yard, down their driveway, and out onto the street, her flip-flops slapping against her feet. She wished she had her bicycle, a hat, some money, and at the same time she wished for nothing in the world but to be alone. Franny couldn't help but believe that she had brought every discomfort she experienced down on herself. Had she done something with her life, no one would be asking her to make them cappuccino. And had she done something with her life, she would be perfectly happy to make them cappuccino, because it would not be her job. She would make the coffee because she was a gracious and helpful person. She could feel good about being kind without continually wondering if she were anything more than a nice enough-looking waitress. She wished, as she approached 30, that she had figured out how to be more than a muse, or as her father had put it the last time she had seen him in Los Angeles, being a mistress isn't a job. Her father hadn't read Commonwealth, but her sister had. There's nothing particularly libelous about it, Caroline said to Franny. He's covered his tracks. I'm grateful that you don't review for the Times. I'll put it another way. I didn't enjoy it, but I'm not going to sue him. You're hardly even in the book. Caroline laughed. Maybe that's what irritated me about it. Anyway, if I was going to sue, I'd make it a class action case, get the whole family involved. Well, Franny said, that would be one way to get us all together again. It was funny how much Franny missed Caroline now. For as much as they'd hated each other growing up, a peculiar fondness had crept in somewhere along the way. Franny and Caroline knew all the same stories. Caroline practiced patent law in Silicon Valley. There was nothing harder than that. She was married to a software designer named Wharton. Wharton was his last name, but no one ever called him anything else because his first name was Eugene. Franny believed that Wharton had softened her sister up. He made Caroline laugh. Franny had no memory of her sister ever laughing about anything when they were growing up, at least never in front of her. Caroline and Wharton had a baby named Nick. Franny got to spend a lot of time with Caroline the semester Leo was teaching at Stanford. Caroline still badgered her about going back to law school, and Franny was able to believe that the badgering came from a place of affection. Believe me, Caroline said, I know school is miserable. I even know that practicing law can be miserable, but sooner or later you have to do something. If you think you're going to find one thing that will be perfect for you, you're going to spend your 80th birthday reading the want ads. You sound like you're trying to talk me into a bad marriage. But it doesn't have to be a bad marriage. Why can't you see that? Get a law degree and go fight housing discrimination, or go get a job for a publisher and write book contracts for authors. Franny smiled and shook her head. I'll figure it out, was what she had said to her sister. But she hadn't figured it out. And now she was in Amagansett, walking through town in order to avoid the man she loved and his friends. Franny looked in shop windows, and when she saw a newspaper on a bench, she sat down and read the entire thing. The light was so soft, so honeyed, that she could almost forgive her houseguests for wanting to stay. She waited until she was sure it was too late for anyone to ask her to make them lunch. She passed the restaurant she and Leo liked, hoping that by some chance she would see him there. Finally, she decided to go back. There was nothing else to do. She had planned to sneak up to the bedroom undetected, but they saw her from the side porch and waved. Franny, what a day we've had without you, Leo said, as if there had been nothing strange about her leaving or her return. Astrid, back from Sag Harbor, nodded. I had to bring the sandwiches for lunch. There's still some sorbet. And Eric and I went into town and bought things for dinner, Marisol said. Someone's still going to have to go back into town, Eric said. We didn't get enough. Franny looked at them up on the porch, everyone softened by the veil of the screen, by the light that was slanting in behind them, by the bank of yellow lilies that separated them from her. It was not unlike seeing tigers at the zoo. Hollinger called, Leo said. He's driving in from the city with Ellen. They should be here in an hour or so. Hollinger? Astrid said. You didn't tell me that. How did he know where you were? John Hollinger was not Astrid's client. His novel, The Seventh Story, had beaten out Commonwealth for the Pulitzer, and both men made a great show of how this fact had not affected their friendship, even though they hadn't exactly been friends in the first place. Marisol gave a single dismissive wave. It won't be an hour. He's always late. There was a time when Franny would have been overwhelmed by the thought of John Hollinger coming for dinner. But that time had passed. Now he and his wife represented nothing more than two extra place settings at the table. This brought them up to 8, assuming that Jonas and Astrid would never leave. What about you? Eric said, glancing down at Franny as if finally remembering she'd been gone. Nice day? Franny shaded her eyes with her hand and looked up at him, puzzled. Sure, she said. That was all they needed to release her from the conversation. There were 6 cardboard boxes on the long wooden table in the kitchen, 6 ears of corn still in their green sleeves. She heard the sound of scratching, and then one of the boxes jerked abruptly forward. Leo came into the kitchen and stood behind her.
I am sorry about Hollinger, he said, kissing the side of her head.
He wasn't asking. He called to announce his impending arrival. We should have rented a motel room in the middle of Kansas for the summer. They would have found us. I spent the day hiding in the cabin so that everyone would think I was writing a novel. Where did you go?
What's in the boxes? Franny said, though of course she knew exactly what was in the boxes.
Marisol thought it would be fun to have lobster.
Franny turned and looked at him. She said she was a vegetarian. Does she know how to cook them?
I don't think it's a science. You just drop them in water.
Listen, he said, putting his hands on her shoulders and looking at her straight on in a way that made him appear very brave.
I have to tell you this, and I'd rather not. Ariel is coming out for a couple of days.
Many things were possible, but Franny and Ariel in the same house was not one of them. For Ariel's sake, Franny stayed out of the entire neighborhood surrounding Gramercy Park when she went to New York. It was the single way they respected one another. They did not overlap.
She wouldn't come out when she knows I'm here, Franny said. I answered the phone.
I think she really just wants to see the house. I made the mistake of telling her about it months ago. I didn't think we were going to rent it then. She said she needs a vacation.
Franny was distracted by the scratching. The boxes, she could see now, were shuffling across the table in microscopic increments. The thought of each separate lobster in the dark was every bit as excruciating as the thought of Ariel Posen coming to Amagansett. Either that, or she was experiencing some sort of emotional transference. Leo followed her gaze to the table.
I should have been a pair of ragged claws, he said, looking at the sad containers trying to get away, scuttling across the floors of silent seas.
Leo, she hates me. That's been made clear. Leo mustered the energy for a wan smile.
Well, maybe this is the summer she stops hating you and we all get along. It's got to happen sooner or later.
When? Franny asked. Not when will she stop hating me, Franny knew the answer to that one, but when is she coming? He sighed and pulled her to him, the wide, warm chest of literature.
She didn't know, probably tomorrow, possibly Tuesday. She said if she got everything together she could come out tonight, but I don't think we need to worry about tonight.
Is she bringing Button? Button was Ariel's daughter, the 4-year-old granddaughter of Leo Posen, the only grandchild. Leo looked at her surprised.
Of course she's bringing Button.
Of course.
Anyone else?
Leo went to the refrigerator and found a bottle of Pinot Gris unfinished from lunch. He poured what was left in a glass sitting out on the sink.
Maybe a boyfriend. There's someone named Hert. I think he's Dutch.
She said she didn't know what Hert's plans were yet. She might be on better behavior if she has someone to impress.
Should I, after tea and cakes and ices, have the strength to force the moment to its crisis?
Franny asked the lobsters.
And what's that supposed to mean?
Leo said. Franny shook her head. Nothing. It's the next line.
It's not the next line, he said, and took his wine out to the porch.
Franny put a pair of scissors in her purse and carried the 6 boxes out to the car. Franny, who felt herself to be without talent, was very adept at carrying more things than anyone would have thought possible. She could feel the lobsters scrabble as their bodies slid heavily into the dark cardboard corners of the boxes.
"Need a hand?"
Jonah said, speeding up his pace when he saw her. He was coming back from the pool, his chest and back unevenly scorched. "I've got it," she said, setting the boxes down to open the car door.
"Are you going into town?"
"Back into town." She arranged her passengers on the floor of the back seat, three on either side.
"Let me just run inside and get my shirt," he said, his face bright with opportunity. "I need some things in town. I'll keep you company."
She started to tell him no, to explain, but instead she nodded. She waited until the kitchen door had closed behind him, waited for another 10 seconds, and then got in the car and drove away. Franny and Leo didn't talk about marriage, except sometimes sentimentally in bed, his hands spreading wide across her back, and even then, it was only to say how quickly they would have married had it not been for the future and the past. What they never spoke of was the prohibitive element in the present, which was Leo's daughter. For the most part, Franny tried her best not to think about Ariel, whom she had met on several disastrous occasions early on in her relationship with Leo. Franny didn't aspire to like Leo's daughter, but she hoped to someday achieve a low level of distant compassion towards her. To that end, she disciplined herself to think of her own father whenever Ariel came up, to imagine Fix showing up with someone younger than she was. Poor dear Marjorie pushed to the side. Fix, taking up with his favorite cocktail waitress, not just for the weekend, but going on 5 years. Her father, in love with this cocktail waitress, who had no means of supporting herself, but who would wait for him in motels when he went on stakeouts. When she could think of things that way, the lava of Ariel's rage against her was easier to bear. The simple truth was that Franny couldn't stand to be hated. Sacred Heart hadn't prepared her for it, and college hadn't prepared her for it. Law school had been doing its best to toughen her up, but then look how she'd done in law school. Franny found a parking spot 2 blocks from the water and carried the 6 boxes down to the end of the pier, past the fishermen with their buckets and lines, past the tourists holding hands. She wanted the lobsters in deep water. Maybe they'd be stupid enough to crawl into someone else's pot tomorrow, but she didn't want them walking straight up on the beach minutes after their exoneration. She set the 6 boxes out in a line and opened them up. Christmas at the pier. Christmas for crustaceans. They were a dappled black and green now, not the electric red they would have been after boiling. They were still frisky, energized by their proximity to salt water, waving their bound claws in impatience. They would never know what they had missed, though, being lobsters, they would probably never know anything. She took the scissors and stuck them in the box, doing her best to cut off the wide rubber bands without nicking a claw or losing a finger. The first band on each one was easy, the second a challenge. When she finished, she tipped them one at a time out of their boxes and into the ocean, where they made a pleasing smack against the water, and then sank from view. By the time Franny had loaded down the car with all the necessary provisions and driven back to the house, it was late in the afternoon. She caught a glimpse of Leo on the front porch talking to someone by the door. 9 for dinner? She had enough. While the rest of them were off who knows where. There was a sleek silver Audi pulled to the back. The Hollingers must have arrived by now. Franny thought how nice it would have been to have taken a shower before she saw them, but that wasn't going to happen. She started carrying the boxes and bags into the kitchen. She'd made 3 trips when Leo came in, with a tall young man with a long black braid.
"Franny?" Leo said.
Franny put the heavy box she was holding down on the table, half liquor, half wine. There was a second case of wine still in the car. She kept her hands on top of the box to keep them steady. That first moment she saw him, she knew exactly what it was she'd done, how serious and wrong it was to have given away what didn't belong to her. She had known it at the time, too, but she hadn't cared. It was the way Leo had listened to her, the way he had asked her so many questions, and then told her to tell him everything again. There had been nothing in her life to equal the light of his attention.
"Christ," Albie said, "you look exactly the same."
He was taller and thinner than she could have ever imagined he would be. He wore a sleeveless t-shirt and some oversized pants covered in pockets. His arms were dark and muscled, his wrists tattooed. He was at once someone she knew as a brother and someone she had never met.
"Not you," Franny said.
Hadn't she thought he'd show up sooner or later? She had expected him around every corner in those first months after the book came out. But time passed. Did she forget about him then? "How did you find us?"
"I found him," Albie said, motioning to Leo. "It turns out he's the easiest person in the world to find."
"That's good to know," Leo said.
"I wasn't thinking about you," Albie said to Franny. "But I guess it makes sense somebody had to have told him." They had wanted to go to the barn and brush the horses. If they brushed the horses and mucked out a few of the stalls, then usually Ned would let them take turns riding the mare for the afternoon. But Albie was driving them crazy. What was he doing that was so intolerable? Standing here in front of him now, Franny couldn't remember. Or maybe he wasn't doing anything wrong. Maybe it was just that someone had to watch him around the horses and none of them wanted to do it. He wasn't the monster they told him he was. In fact, there wasn't anything so awful about him. It was only that he was a little kid. "Albie has terrible breath," Franny announced. Then she turned to him. "Didn't you brush your teeth this morning?" That was how the ball got rolling. Holly leaned in and sniffed the air in front of her brother's face. She rolled her eyes. "Tic-tac, please." Caroline looked at Cal. "You might as well. You know he's never going to brush his teeth. I don't think he's brushed them since we got here." Cal pulled the little plastic bag out of his pocket. He had four in there, and so gave him four.
"All of them?" Albie asked.
"You stink," Cal said. "If you don't, you're going to scare the horses."
Jeanette left the room then. She didn't say where she was going, but the rest of them said they had to wait for her.
"I want to go," Albie said.
Franny shook her head. "Ernestine told us we had to stay together." They waited until he fell asleep. It never took that long. Cal carried Albie down to the laundry room and left him under a pile of towels on the floor. It was Sunday, and Ernestine was making a big supper. She never did laundry on Sunday. And now, 20 years later, here was Albie in the actress's summer house, having read about the day he had largely slept through in a novel written by someone he'd never met. Franny shook her head. Her hands were cold. She had never been so cold before.
"I'm sorry," she said.
The words came without volume, and so she said them again.
"I know it isn't worth anything, but I'm sorry. I made a terrible mistake."
"How did you make a mistake?" Leo said.
He reached into the box and took out the bottle of Beefeater.
"I'm going to have a drink. Would anyone else like a drink?"
"Did you think I was never going to see it?" Albie asked. "I mean, maybe that was a good guess. It took me long enough."
"I was trying to explain to him before you got here," Leo said, pouring some gin in a glass. "Writers get their inspirations from a lot of places. It's never any one thing."
Franny looked at Leo, willing him to pick up his glass and go back out on the porch to smoke with his guests.
"Just give us a minute," she said to him. "This isn't about you."
"Of course it's about me," Leo said. "It's my book."
"I still don't understand this," Albie said, pointing at Franny and then at Leo. "How did he wind up with my life?"
"It isn't your life," Leo said. "That's what I'm trying to explain. It's my imagination."
Albie swung around like a whip, his hands coming up to Leo's shoulders, pushing him back. Leo, startled, dropped his glass on the floor, and for a moment, the room was suffused with the clean smell of gin.
You don't understand why I'm here, do you? Alpi said. You have no idea how hard I'm trying not to kill you. I really might. And if you made me up, then you'll understand just how little there is at stake for me here.
There was a clear case for stepping towards Leo then, for putting her hands on Leo's arm. But Franny turned to Albie instead. Albie was the one she had wronged. She and Leo had wronged him together.
Listen to me. Let's go and talk, she said to Albie. Come outside and talk to me.
Leo stumbled back as if struck, his face flushed. Leo, shorter, heavier, more than twice Albie's age, would later swear there had been a blow. The highball glass rolled past his feet, miraculously unbroken.
I'm calling the police, he said.
He could hear the unevenness in his own breathing.
Nobody's calling the police, Franny said.
What in the hell are you talking about? Leo said.
Marisol came in the kitchen through the swinging door, Eric behind her.
Franny, where are my lobsters? She said.
Franny couldn't think of what she was talking about at first or why she was even still in the house. But then she remembered.
Go, she said. She kept her eyes on Albie.
Do you even know what lobsters cost?
Eric touched his wife's shoulder. Come back to the living room, he said. They've got company.
We're the company!
Marisol had put on a silk shift dress of emerald green and a flat gold necklace. The Hollingers had come, and she was dressed for dinner. Only Hollinger was a bigger name on the marquee than Posen, and some might disagree with that. Hollinger had been more consistent in his career. He'd had the bigger wins. Dinner, unassembled, was on the table in the boxes in the shopping bags.
Jonas told me you put them in the car. Was something wrong with them?
Albie turned to Franny.
Do you work for them?
Franny took her hand off Albie's arm and put her hand in his hand instead.
We have to go.
Who is this? Marisol said.
Marisol, who wasn't part of anything, who had never been invited.
This is my brother, Franny said.
He is not your goddamn brother,
Leo said, his voice loud enough to go through the windows and out across the lawns. Franny had made a mistake when she'd left the house that morning without taking her purse, and she did not make the mistake again.
Stay here, she said to Leo. Everything's going to be fine.
Albie picked up the bottle of gin.
You're not leaving with him, Leo said.
If I don't leave here with him, I'm going to invite him to dinner. I'm going to put him upstairs in the guest room, okay?
I'll tell you what, Eric said. Why don't we take some drinks out to our guests? Marisol, you get the corkscrew and some glasses. Maybe we should all sit down and have a drink. You've got the gin.
Eric nodded at Albie. Then he turned to Franny.
The Hollingers are here. They came while you were in town. Just come out and say hello.
Eric was trying to turn the evening back into a dinner party. It occurred to Franny then that, of course, he wouldn't know who Albie was. He wouldn't know who she was either, other than Leo's girlfriend, because when Leo called her his inspiration, and he always did, no one thought he meant it literally. The story of two couples moving in next door to each other, their awful children, that was nothing more than the plot of a novel, as far as Eric was concerned. Franny wanted to go to Leo to reassure him, but Marisol had opened the door from the kitchen. Everyone could hear the voices coming in from the front hallway. So many voices. Hello, hello. The sound of car doors, of laughter. The sound of Ariel's voice calling out for her father. If Beverly or Bert were to tell the story now, they would say they divorced after Cal died. And of course that was true, they had. But in this instance, the word after would be misleading. It linked together the death and the divorce as if they were cause and effect, as if Beverly and Bert were one of those couples who, upon a child's death, are led down such separate paths of grief that they can no longer find their way back to one another. This was not the case. Bert blamed Beverly for leaving the 6 children alone on the farm with Ernestine and his parents, for not telling anyone she was taking his mother's car into Charlottesville to sit through 2 back-to-back showings of Harry and Tonto. She hadn't planned to see it twice, but the theater was so empty and quiet and cool. She had cried at the end of the picture and all through the credits, and rather than walk into the lobby with her mascara running, she just decided to stay where she was. Did he really think she supervised the children every minute? Did he think that, had she stayed home that afternoon, after reading another book up in their room, another magazine, taking one more nap, after she had officially died of boredom, she might have gone with them to the barn and curried the horses? The truth was, she left the children alone in Arlington, too. She left them in order to preserve her sanity. At least at the farm there was adult supervision. Did his parents bear no responsibility for what happened on their property? And what about Ernestine? Beverly had left the children in Ernestine's care, even if she hadn't told Ernestine that's what she was doing. Ernestine had more parental sense than Beverly and Bert and Bert's parents all combined, and Ernestine thought it was fine for them to walk the half a mile to the barn. Bert should not have insisted that Beverly and the children stay at his parents' house in the country for the week while he took the station wagon back to Arlington for work. If he thought that the children needed an escort to the barn, then he should have stuck around and escorted them himself. Beverly didn't want to be a guest in his parents' house. They were forever asking the children about their wonderful mother. "How's Teresa? What's Teresa doing now? I hope your mother knows she's always welcome to come and stay with us." The children didn't want to stay with Bert's parents either. They had been much happier at the Pine Cone, where they had stayed in summers past. At Bert's parents' house, they had to take their shoes off at the back door and wipe their feet with a towel. Because they weren't allowed in the living room under any circumstances, they had inevitably made a game out of dashing through at top speed on dares whenever they heard someone coming down the hall. A porcelain figurine of an English gentleman and his wolfhound was knocked from an end table and smashed. Bert's parents didn't want them there. They had made the offer of this extended and highly unusual visit in hopes of seeing their son, not his children, or his second wife, or her children. But then, Bert left. Ernestine didn't want them there. She couldn't have. It meant 8 extra mouths to feed, 7 after Bert decamped. Piles of laundry, games to invent, fights to break up, employers to soothe. The load fell heaviest on Ernestine's shoulders, and yet she alone carried her burden without complaint. Bert went back to Arlington because under the circumstances of a normal work week, it was expensive, impractical, and stimulatingly dangerous to find a place to continue his affair with his paralegal. Linda Dale, 2 first names, she did not answer to Linda, said for once she would like to have dinner together in a restaurant like regular people, go to bed in a real bed, wake up in the middle of the night and make love while they were still half asleep, and then do it again in the shower the next morning. Bert was not crazy about Linda Dale. She was petulant and demanding and very young. But she talked like this on the phone when he called the office, so what was he supposed to do? Stay at the farm? He was in the office when his mother called to tell him about Cal. He jumped in his car and broke every speed limit, making the 3-hour drive to the hospital in Charlottesville in just under 2.5. Like any parent would do. There wasn't time to go home and straighten up the house. He never thought of it. Sometimes it was hard for Beverly and Bert to remember what had destroyed them. When Beverly wept over the affair, the unfamiliar red panties surfacing in her unmade bed, Bert was aghast. The death of a child trumped infidelity. The death of a child trumped everything. It was a logic Beverly could nearly embrace. If pain and loss could be ranked, then surely Bert had won, and this was the time for them to pull together, for the sake of their marriage or their remaining children. But accepting the circumstances didn't turn out to be the same as forgiveness. They bound themselves together with a little tape and soldiered on. and even though their marriage held for nearly 6 years after Cal's death, neither of them would remember it that way. They would say that their separate griefs had broken them apart much earlier. If the end of Beverly and Bert's marriage could not rightfully be attributed to Cal, neither could it be pinned on Albie, though the couple's emotional resources were so depleted by the time Albie arrived from California that he didn't have to do much of anything but watch them go over the cliff. The mere fact that he had come turned out to be enough. 5 years, 2 months, and 27 days after Cal died, Albie had dropped a lit book of matches into the trash can of the art room of Cherry High in Torrance. Teresa called Bert and told him about the fire, told him through her exhausted tears that Albie was being held in juvenile. Bert hung up and had Beverly call her ex-husband to get the kid out. With that behind them, Bert called Teresa back to tell her what an incompetent parent she was. Saturday morning, and she didn't even know where their only son had gone to on his bike. He told her the home she provided was unfit, unsafe, and she had no choice but to send Albie to him. Bert had this conversation on the phone in the kitchen, where Beverly was sautéing onions to start a stroganoff for dinner. She turned off the fire beneath the pan and walked slowly up the stairs to Caroline's bedroom. She often hid in Caroline's room now that her older daughter had gone to college. Bert never thought to look for her there. Of course, there were many things Teresa could have volleyed back, but at the heart of her ex-husband's bombastic cruelty was one simple truth. She couldn't keep Albie safe. She didn't necessarily think Bert could do it either. But different friends, a different school, the other side of the country, might afford Albie a better chance. On Monday morning, the principal called to say that Albie and the other boys were suspended pending investigation, and if the investigation found them guilty, which was likely, considering they had been seen running out of the burning building on a Saturday morning and had confessed to starting the fire, they would be expelled. On Tuesday, she called Bert back. She was putting Albie on a plane. Albie, nearly 15, walked as far as the back patio, dropped his suitcase, sat down in a white wrought iron chair, and lit a cigarette. His father was still trying to wrestle the giant sheets of cardboard that had been taped together to form a sort of box around the bicycle from the back of the station wagon. Bert had already told him on the ride in from Dulles that Beverly wouldn't be home for dinner tonight. On Thursday nights, Beverly took a French class at the community college, and after that went to dinner with her school friends, where they practiced conversational French.
"She's trying to find herself," his father said, and Albie looked out the window. "How was he getting home from the airport, then?" Bert had asked her when Beverly announced she wasn't going to be there. He walked right into that one.
When he got the bike unwrapped, Bert wheeled it out of the garage like it was Christmas morning. He had meant to say, "Look at this, good as new." But instead, he saw the pack of cigarettes and, more distressingly, the red Bic lighter sitting on the table in front of his son. The bike didn't seem to have a kickstand, so he leaned it against one of the patio chairs.
"You aren't allowed to have a lighter," Bert said, though it came out as more of a question than he'd meant it to.
Albie looked at him, puzzled.
"Why not?" "Because you burned down your goddamn school. Are you telling me your mother didn't ground you from fire?"
Albie smiled at the sheer expansiveness of his father's stupidity.
"I didn't burn down the school. I set a fire in the art room. It was an accident, and they needed a new art room. The school is already open again."
"I'll say it then. You're grounded from fire. That means no arson and no cigarettes."
Albie took a long draw on his cigarette. He turned his head respectfully and blew the smoke to the side. He was respectfully smoking the cigarette outside the house in the first place. "Fire is an element. It's like water or air."
"So, you're grounded from an element."
Can I use the gas stove?
They were both looking at the lighter on the table. When Bert reached down to take it, Albie swept it into his hand, looking right at him. That was the moment. Either Bert would hit his son, or he would not. Albie held his cigarette down and lifted his face, eyes wide open. Bert straightened up, stepped back. He had never hit his children. He would not hit them now. The few times he'd ever smacked Cal played in his daydreams on a continuous loop.
"Don't smoke in the house," Bert said, and went inside.
Albie stared up at the house. It was not the one he'd come to as a child. It wasn't any house he'd ever seen before. At some point between the last time he was in Virginia and now, Bert and Beverly had moved, and failed to mention that fact to Holly or Albie or Jeanette. And why should they, when no one thought that Holly or Albie or Jeanette would ever visit again? But his father hadn't mentioned the new house at the airport, either. Did he forget? Did he think Albie wouldn't notice? This place was blood-red brick with fluted white columns in the front, a junior relation of the house his grandparents lived in outside Charlottesville. It was heavily landscaped with plants and trees he didn't recognize, everything orderly and neat. He could see the edge of a swimming pool already covered in tarp for the winter. He could look in the window from the patio and see the kitchen, see the fancy copper pots that hung from a rack on the ceiling. But if he got up and opened the door and walked through the kitchen, he wouldn't know which way he was supposed to turn. He wouldn't know what bedroom he was supposed to sleep in. Caroline would be off in college by now, and if Albie were to guess, he would guess that she had plenty of friends who invited her to their houses for the holidays. She probably had some all-encompassing summer job as a camp counselor or government intern that prevented her from ever coming home or even using a payphone. Caroline had always made it clear that once she got out of there, she wasn't coming back. Caroline was a bitch by any standard, but she was also the one who had organized all the subversive acts of their childhood summers. She hated them all, especially her own sister. But Caroline got things done. When he thought of her, cracking open the station wagon with a coat hanger and getting the gun out of the glove compartment, he shook his head. He had never in his life adored anyone the way he adored Caroline. That meant it would just be Franny. He hadn't seen either of the girls since the summer visits to Virginia had stopped 5 years ago, but Franny was harder for him to fix in his mind. It was weird, since she was the person in the family closest to him in age. He remembered that she was always carrying the cat around, and in his memory, the girl and the cat had merged. Sweet and small, eager to please, quick to nap, always crawling into somebody's lap. Albie stayed on the back patio and smoked, while the light turned gold across the suburbs and the cold air pricked his arms. He didn't want to go in the house and ask his father where he'd be sleeping. He thought about rummaging through his suitcase and finding the generous bag of weed his friends had put together as a going-away present. But he figured he'd already pushed the limits of brazenness for one day. It would have been one thing if his lighter were confiscated in a world full of free matchbooks, but he didn't want anyone taking his pot away. He could ride his bike around the new neighborhood, acquaint himself with what was there, but he stayed seated. Thinking about moving was as far as he'd gotten when Franny pulled into the driveway and parked. She was wearing a white blouse with the sleeves rolled up and a blue plaid skirt, knee socks, saddle shoes, the universal attire of Catholic schoolgirls. She was skinny and pale with her hair pulled back, and when he stood up and dropped his cigarette, he had a split second of uncertainty as to whether or not there was goodwill between them. Franny dropped her backpack on the ground and came straight to him, arms out. Franny, not understanding that he lived on the other side of a thick wall and so no one could take him into their arms, took him into her arms and squeezed him hard. She was warm and strong and smelled slightly, pleasantly, of girl sweat.
Welcome home, she said. Two words.
He looked at her.
Are they making you stay outside? She asked, looking down at his suitcase. Can you at least go in the garage?
I like it out here. Franny looked at the house. The light in Bert's study was on.
Then we'll stay out here. What can I get for you? You must be hungry.
Albie looked hungry, not only in the unnerving thinness that all the cousins' children possessed, but in his hollow eyes. Albie looked like he could eat an entire pig, python style, and it still wouldn't begin to address the deficit.
To tell you the truth, I could use a drink.
Name it, Franny said. She was half turned toward the house, her mind already considering the secret stash of 7-Up her mother disapproved of.
Gin.
She looked back at Albie and smiled. Gin, on a Thursday night.
Did I tell you I'm glad you're here? Probably not yet. I'm glad you're here. Are you going to come with me?
I will in a minute, he said. While she was gone, Albie looked at the sky. There were animals zipping around up there. Sparrows, bats, along with the near-deafening roar of something cricketish. He wasn't in Torrance anymore. In a minute, Franny came back with two glasses half full of ice and gin, a bottle of 7-Up under her arm. She topped off her glass with the soda, used her finger to stir it around, and then looked at him, wagging the 7-Up back and forth.
Pass, he said.
Very manly. They tapped their glasses together the way people did in movies, the way her girlfriends did at slumber parties, after siphoning off what could be taken discreetly from the family supply. Franny had had some drinks before, not just at home, not on a school night, not with Albie. But if ever there was a day to break the rules, it was today.
Cheers.
She made a little face at the taste while Albie just sipped and smiled. He lit another cigarette because it went so nicely with the gin. It felt like they were catching up just sitting there not talking. Too much had happened. Too much time had passed to try putting it into words now. After a while, Bert came back out. He seemed so happy to see Franny there. He kissed the side of her head, the cloud of cigarette smoke eradicating the smell of gin.
I didn't know you were home.
Both of us, Franny said, smiling.
Bert jingled his car keys.
I'm gonna get a pizza.
Franny shook her head.
Mom made dinner. It's all in the fridge. I'll heat it up.
Bert looked surprised, though it would be hard to say why. Beverly always made dinner. He picked up Albie's suitcase.
You kids come inside now. It's getting cold out here.
The three of them went inside, just as the deep darkness of night was setting in. Franny and Albie picked up their glasses, the cigarettes, and the lighter, and followed Albie's father through the door. Chapter 7
So Bert Cousins' kid was the one who broke you and the old Jew up? Fix said.
They were on their way to Santa Monica, the car windows down. They were going to the movies. Caroline was driving. Franny was in the back, leaning forward between the two seats.
How have I never heard that part of the story? Caroline asked.
Would you please not call him the old Jew? Franny said to her father.
Sorry, Fix covered his heart with his hand. The old drunk. May God rest his soul in Zion. Hats off to the kid is my point. He's finally earned my respect.
Franny imagined calling Albie with that bit of news.
It wasn't like I left the house that night and never went back. We stayed at Amagansett all summer.
There was Ariel and her intolerable Dutch boyfriend and sad little Button to deal with. The entire long, horrible summer of house guests to endure. The end of Leo and Franny's relationship played to a full house. It was more than 20 years ago, and still the complete misery of that time was fully accessible to her.
But essentially that was that, right? Fix said. The kid put the nail in the tire.
Caroline shook her head.
Albie identified the fact that the tire had a nail in it, she said, and Franny, surprised by the accuracy of her sister's assessment, laughed.
I should have stayed in law school, Franny said. Then I'd have been as smart as you. Caroline shook her head. Not possible.
Get over, Elaine, Fix said, pointing. You're taking a left at the light.
Fix had his Thomas Brothers street guide in his lap. He refused to let Franny put the theater's address into her phone.
Do you have any idea how it could have taken this long to make the movie?
Caroline glanced in the rearview mirror, then accelerated deftly to get the better of an oncoming Porsche. As with so many other things in life, Caroline was the superior driver.
It happens. Leo wouldn't sell the film right, so nothing could have started until after he died.
I can't imagine his wife was easy to work with. Natalie Posen. They were, miraculously, still married when Leo died 15 years ago, still battling it out. All those years, his wife, and now his widow. Franny saw her just that one time at the funeral, so much smaller than she would have imagined, sitting in the front row of the synagogue, flanked by two sons who looked like Leo, one from the nose up, the other from the nose down, as if each had inherited half his father's head. Ariel was on the other side of the synagogue with a very grown-up Button and her own mother, the first Mrs. Leon Posen. Eric was listed in the program as an honorary pallbearer, too old himself to lift 1/6 of the casket's weight by that point. He'd been the one to call Franny with the news of Leo's death, thoughtful, considering all the time that had passed. She'd asked about the next book, the one of the long-ago advance that he was always supposed to be writing. Eric said no, sadly, it wasn't there. They were all there, time having run them down. Eric and Marisol, Astrid, the Hollingers, a dozen more. All the summer guests come to claim him along with the rest of the world. Franny stayed at the back, standing against the wall in the peanut gallery of former students and devoted fans and old girlfriends. Natalie Posen had chosen to bury her husband in Los Angeles, giving her spite the air of the eternal.
The wife, Fix said. As long as we're thinking of things to feel good about, let's thank the wife.
Leo's wife? Fix nodded. She's the unsung hero in all this.
How do you figure?
It was Fix's birthday, 83, with metastases to the brain. Franny was making her best effort.
If she hadn't hung in there like a pit bull to get more money, Leo Posen would have been a free man.
Ah, Caroline nodded. She colored her hair the warm reddish shade of brown it had been when they were children. She went to Pilates 3 times a week. She had followed their mother's example, kept herself up. Caroline had become the younger sister.
I'm not seeing your point, Franny said.
Fix smiled. Caroline, as far as he was concerned, had never missed a trick.
If Leo had ever gotten a divorce, her sister explained, he would have married you.
Franny, girl, their father said, turning with difficulty to look at her.
That may have been the only bullet you ever dodged.
Franny and Caroline had long agreed it was a waste of resources for them to visit either parent at the same time. With divorced parents on opposite sides of the country and husbands whose parents also required a certain number of family holidays, Franny and Caroline divided their burden in order to conquer it. There were only so many vacation days, personal leave days, plane tickets, missed school plays, and unexcused absences between them. Whatever affection the two sisters had found for each other later in life would not be manifesting itself in visits. Los Angeles was as close as Franny ever got to the Bay Area, though she meant to go. Albie lived there now, 2 hours away from Caroline. Caroline's oldest son, Nick, was a senior at Northwestern, so at least when Caroline and Wharton came out for parents' weekend, Franny could drive up to Evanston to see the three of them. Caroline's other two children, the girls, Franny had missed out on entirely, much the same way Caroline had missed out on Franny's two boys. But Ravi and Amit, no matter how long she'd had them, were not actually Franny's. They had come with the marriage, and Caroline, try as she might to feel otherwise, could never grant full citizenship to stepchildren. All of which was to say
that under normal circumstances, neither Franny nor Caroline would necessarily have traveled to Los Angeles to celebrate Fix's birthday. But since Fix had already exceeded the outer limits of his oncologist's predictions, they both stepped up their game. This birthday was going to be his last. A quick glance over to the passenger seat confirmed this, and in honor of the occasion, the two sisters broke their arrangement and met in California.
"So, what are we going to do for the big day?" Caroline had asked the night before. "Sky's the limit."
They were sitting in the den, the four of them, in the house in Santa Monica that Fix and Marjorie had moved to when they finally left Downey after retirement. It was something of a miracle, that house. In no way splendid, except that it was two blocks from the beach. It was 40 years ago that Fix had known a cop who played poker with a bankruptcy judge. He had a tip the place was coming up at auction. That was when Fix finally told Marjorie he'd marry her. They would use her recent inheritance from her aunt in Ohio as the down payment. They would buy it, rent it out for 20 years or so, and by the time they were ready to retire, they'd practically own it.
"That's your proposal?" Marjorie had said, but she took the offer.
"But what was Dad's part in all of it?" Franny had asked her years later when she finally heard the full story. Fix and Marjorie had driven the girls by the Santa Monica house every time they came to visit. They would point it out from the car, saying they owned it, saying one day they were going to live there.
"If you were the one with the money, then why did you have to marry him? You could have just bought the place yourself and rented it."
"Your father wanted a house at the beach, and I wanted to marry your father."
Marjorie laughed when she heard how that sounded. She tried again.
"He wanted to marry me. He was just slower to figure it out. I like to think that in the end, everybody won."
Marjorie had just finished pushing the nutritional supplement into Fix's peg tube. She was a young 75 to his old 83. But it seemed that Marjorie had stopped eating about the same time her husband did. Her shoulder blades pushed out like a wire rack beneath her sweater.
"Let's go to the show," Fix said. "We'll see a matinee of Franny's movie."
"Fix," Marjorie said, her voice tired. "We talked about this."
"My movie?" Franny asked, but of course she knew what he was talking about. He'd called it her book.
"The one your boyfriend wrote about us. I figure I've got one chance to see a movie about my life."
Fix appeared wonderfully satisfied by the thought.
"I never read the book, you know. I wasn't going to give the son of a bitch my money. But now he's dead and the money will go to his wife, it's fine by me. Plus, I read the review in the paper that said the woman who plays your mother wasn't any good. I'm thinking that must really burn her up."
Marjorie raised a slender hand.
"I'm out. You and the girls make a day of it. I'll be here with cupcakes when you get back."
A few free hours were worth a month of pension checks.
"Oh, Dad," Caroline said, "wouldn't it be more fun to stay home and pull our toenails out with pliers?"
Franny had her share of guilt and dread when Commonwealth was published, but still, she would never deny that those were glorious days. The publisher's luncheon at La Grenouille, the award ceremony in which Leo was